Do you have a special tree in your life? I do. It's an old gnarled maple on my favorite mountain hike in Vermont. The main limbs were once ripped off by a lightning strike, and those charred remains are now decomposing on the ground below. At first, the tree looks dead, but when you look closer, you see leaves in the upper branches reaching out toward the sun. Against all odds, this tree lives on. There's something miraculous about this craggy maple, and every time I walk by, I wonder what it's witnessed over the centuries, standing there year after year as animals and people and younger trees have come and gone. My own life barely registers on this time scale. I'm Steve Paulson, and I want to welcome you to a new episode in our series on kinship with the more than human world. This is different from what you normally hear on To the Best of Our Knowledge. It's a single long interview, the kind of wide-ranging conversation that we just don't have time for on the radio show. My guest is Suzanne Simard, the forest ecologist who discovered that trees are social creatures. She showed how fungal networks fuse with tree roots to create complex systems of communication within a forest, so trees can share nutrients and also information with each other. They seem to learn and remember, and we now know that a forest has its own kind of intelligence. Simard herself has become something of a cultural icon. Her concept of the mother tree inspired the Tree of Souls in the blockbuster movie Avatar. And she was the model for one of the main characters in Richard Power's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Overstory. But 30 years ago, Simard was a lone voice in the wilderness, one of the few female forest ecologists at the time, and an outspoken critic of commercial logging practices. She tells this story in her memoir, Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. One thing I find so fascinating is how Simard understands trees. There's a lot of science, but it's also intuitive. She knows trees like no one else I've ever met. So our conversation gets very personal, and by the end, we get into why she talks to trees. I hope you enjoy it. Here is Suzanne Simard. So Suzanne, considering all your work as a forest ecologist, I think it would surprise a lot of people that you actually grew up in a family of loggers.
Yeah.
I mean, logging is usually seen as the industry that is destroying forests. And I'm wondering how those early years out with your family in these remote forests, how did that shape your thinking?
Well, I think it shaped me at the very core. It was just how I grew up. It's what we did. So it was in my blood and bones and DNA. Of course, as a kid, I didn't know that it might be unique that I grew up in a family of horse loggers, but I grew up thinking of the forest as a safe haven. Horse logging was a regenerative practice, not a destructive practice. So when I finally became a forester myself, my mind was opened up to this other way of seeing the world, which was kind of disturbing.
Well, it's interesting that you say for you it was a regenerative practice. Can you explain that? Because that's not the way, you know, people who are not in the business see an industry that cuts down trees.
Well, the forest I grew up in were inland rainforest, you know, lots of precipitation with huge trees, cedars and hemlocks and white pines and spruces. And when my grandfather and great-grandfather and uncles and father logged, they would just take out a few trees. They were after certain trees, like the white pines were really valuable. So that was what they first started on. But eventually they were logging for cedar poles for when they were putting telephone poles across Canada. And so they would just really go in and select those special trees, just one or two at a time. And they created these small gaps in the forest. And those gaps filled in with seed and naturally regenerated. So to me, it was just opening up the forest. So it was no trouble at all for those forests to just rejuvenate themselves after this light touch of logging.
So this is totally different than the big commercial logging operations businesses where like whole stretches of a mountain will essentially be clear cut.
Yeah. So I started as a young forester and I got a job with the forest industry in the 1980s, late 1970s. And that was when this commercial clear cutting, which is what you're describing, was getting started. And I was working for a company actually at the time when there was the first mountain pine beetle attack, at least that I remembered. But it was an excuse to clear cut from one end of a valley to another. So I saw whole valleys being removed. And this was really taking off throughout British Columbia and Western Canada, and I know Western North America as well, as the way to harvest forests. And it brought a lot of money. It was lucrative.
From the timber industry's perspective, I'm assuming, you know, what they want to do is to get trees cheap and fast.
Yeah, exactly. So not just taking the trees that they needed or were after, but taking everything because it was cheaper. It was definitely cheaper to go in there and just clear cut. And eventually chainsaws got replaced by feller bunchers. And now feller bunchers are actually the operators operate within a cab that they don't actually ever have to get out of the machine. It became more and more mechanized over time, and the clear cutting became more and more efficient, which made more and more money for these companies.
So what's the problem with that?
The problem is that the regenerative capacity of forests is really linked to the past, right? So the seeds, the plants, the old trees, they all play a role in bootstrapping that ecosystem to recovery. So if you take out all the trees, for example, and really in my neck of the woods in British Columbia, there are some clear cuts that are 1,000 hectares. And when you have a clear cut that size, there's not much seed source. There's no neighbors that are nearby, and so the seed source goes down. So that's one consequence. Another one is old trees actually provide not just seed, but they provide networks that, which are what I studied, the below ground networks with fungi that are symbiotic with the trees that are really essential to helping the new trees get started. Also, like old trees provide habitat for all kinds of species like woodpeckers and even bears, all kinds of songbirds that rely on these old trees for their livelihoods. And I'll say one more thing is that they also store a ton of carbon, which is really important today in the era of climate change.
So I want to take you back again to your personal story. So growing up in this family of loggers, and you said that the forest was a safe haven for you, because I'm wondering where your ideas originally started percolating, that there was a different way to think about a forest than scientists thought about, than traditional loggers thought about. I mean, where did these ideas come from for you?
Well, I think just from being a kid of the forest. Imagine in the forest, all these different species, the trees are huge, their roots overlap with each other. There are plants, wall-to-wall plants, devil's club, thimbleberries, huckleberries, orchids, they're all in there together, growing in these very distinct patterns, I guess, adapted to their sites. And it just was part of what I knew. And so I guess it started then. It started as soon as I could walk, as soon as I could get out there. I became fascinated with soils, the stuff that you could dig in, because I love dirt. You know, my brother and I would always make these forts and throw dirt lumps. And but I also love to eat dirt, you know. So there you can see, I have pictures of when I was just a little baby, my mouth full of dirt and worms. And, I guess I just loved it. And even our dog falling in the outhouse and watching my uncles and grandfather trying to dig jigs out of the outhouse. That was fascinating.
You have a great story about that in your book. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, well, you know, we used to live every summer on Maple Lake. It's in the inland rainforest. And my grandfather and his brothers and sons, that's where they logged. And my uncle Wilfred had a dog named Jigs. And one morning we got up and we could hear Jigs howling. Jigs was a beagle, and he was a curious beagle. He was always getting into trouble, but this was like the ultimate trouble. And he had fallen in the outhouse. And so
down into the toilet?
Yeah. You know, he must have been looking down the hole, and right. He was probably going, what's going on down there? And in he went.
How did they dig him out then?
So I was about 6 at the time, and we all were all like hovering around, like laughing, and there's flies everywhere, and it stunk. And my grandfather and great uncle, they got their shovels and picks, and they started digging out the sides of the outhouse because he was way down there. It was about 6 feet down. And so it took a while, but they started, you know, first they had to clear away the forest floor and get the mushrooms out of the way and the twigs. And then they started digging through the forest floor, which was, to me, was like the best. I loved eating forest floor, especially if there were birch trees around. And so I was watching that actually the forest floor was full of bugs, right? Like worms and mites and Columbula, but it was alive. And it was complicated. And then once they got through the forest floor, there was this white sandy stuff that wasn't really sand, but it was like drenched of color. And underneath that, there was this incredibly red soil. And now I know those soils are called podzols. And in the US, you call them spodosols, but they're the kind of soil that develops under a rainforest. And eventually they got down to the glacial till. So Canada was glaciated in the last ice age. And so then the digging got really hard. And so then they were like, oh my God, how do we get these big rocks out of the way? And eventually, Jigs, we were able to rescue Jigs and haul him out. And he was, you know, covered in poop and toilet paper. But it was a great successful operation.
Well, it sounds like this amazing science lesson too. I mean, you sort of got to see several feet, 6 feet or so of forest being uncovered, the dirt, the ground. I mean, it's like, wow, what a remarkable discovery.
It was, and so colorful. I was only six, so you have to imagine as a six-year-old, but that there are these layers, right? There's the layers like a layer cake, and Jigs was down there at the bottom of this big cake of all these different layers. And I found that just amazing that under our feet, there's like a big city down there. And most of us don't really see that, but I saw it. And I was attracted to it because I was just a kid that loved dirt.
So when did you decide, when did you decide that you actually wanted to make a career out of studying forests?
My mother really instilled in us kids that we needed to get a good education and go to university. So off I went to the University of British Columbia, which at the time, there were no universities or colleges where I lived out in the bush. And so I had to move to the big city, which was shocking. I didn't even know how to take the bus, for Pete's sakes. But anyway, off I go. And I had a friend who said, you could be a forester. You could go into the Faculty of Forestry. And I'm like, well, what's forestry? I didn't know what forestry was. Right. And he says, like how your grandpa worked. I'm like, oh, well, that sounds kind of cool. And off I went and I never looked back. I absolutely loved it.
Now, I know you also had some jobs early on. Maybe this was even during your college years where you worked for the logging industry, which meant you were out kind of in the middle of nowhere in some of these remote forests, which was also grizzly country in Western Canada. And you have some amazing stories where you ran into some grizzlies. One happened, I think, when you were 20 years old. You encountered a mother grizzly and her cub. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, so grizzlies were a constant presence. They were constantly in my mind because I often worked on my own, or there might be two of us, and we would be right in grizzly country and saw grizzlies regularly. And you had to be careful. But in this particular occasion, my friend Jean and I, who worked with me, had decided to go backpacking one weekend in the Stein River Valley, which is one of the huge untouched watersheds that were in the area right adjacent to where my company worked. So we were climbing into this hanging valley. It was my birthday. And the further up we went, the more signs of grizzly that we saw. And we got to this huge waterfall and we saw huge grizzly tracks. And we thought, well, we were used to grizzlies, but it was getting more and more concerning because pretty soon we started seeing big claw marks coming down the tree. So the grizzlies were actually putting up their warning signs and then ripped out cow's parsnip, which is like one of their favorite foods. And Jean and I just said, we got to get out of here. So we turned around and we went back down the mountain and actually stayed overnight partway, which was a story into itself. But then the next day, as we were leaving this place where we camped, there was this really strong smell of cache. And cache is rotten meat that was brought in by a grizzly overnight. And I could smell it. And I'm like, Jean, we got to get out of here. And so we left really quickly. And we were going down the mountain and got into these Douglas fir forests, which normally aren't strong grizzly country. So I thought, oh, we're safe now. But partway down, Jean stopped dead in her tracks. And there was a mama grizzly with her two cubs only a few feet from us. I mean, we could literally feel her breath on our faces. And Jean, who was much braver than me, she turned around and she says, okay, I'm going up that tree. And she dropped her pack and up the tree she went. And so I'm like, okay. And I forgot to drop my pack and I went for another tree and I'm going up and trying to keep up with her in my tree. And she's going way, way up. In the meantime, Mama Grizzly has sent her cubs up another tree and I'm going up and up. And pretty soon my tree was getting smaller and smaller and smaller and it starts to sway. back and forth, and I'm going, oh my God, I picked a small tree.
And of course, a grizzly can climb a tree too.
Well, grizzlies can't actually climb trees. They're too heavy.
Oh, they are. Okay.
But the cubs can climb trees because they're quite light, right? But my tree was bending over so much, I was worried that every time it bent over, that the mama grizzly could actually stand up on her hind legs and grab me out of the tree. But it turns out she didn't. She was so interested in, you know, staying at the base of her own cubs trees that she left me alone. And we stayed in those trees for over an hour. And she just stayed at the bottom, kind of keeping her cubs safe and then making sure, you know, that we weren't going to do anything. And then after that hour, we could hear the cubs coming down the tree. Scratch, 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 scratch. And they came down the tree. And then we waited another half an hour and heard nothing. And then Jean says, okay, you know, we got to go. Anyway, the bears had gone and we just ran down the mountain and back to the river. We were so lucky.
Wow.
We were pretty terrified, but, you know, we survived.
So you went on to do your doctoral work on Douglas firs and the relationship actually between Douglas fir and paper birch in British Columbia. What did you find?
So I was working in this kind of forest because it was the inland rainforest, and those old forests were being clear cut and then planted to Douglas fir in the hopes that they could recreate, you know, these valuable old trees that they were making a ton of money on. The Forest Service in British Columbia at that time had just enacted this new law called Free to Grow. And it required that these Douglas firs and all the trees that they planted were free of anything that might compete with them. And that included paper birch and all the deciduous trees, as well as all the native plants. I called it a war at the time, where they were trying to get rid of all these plants. And paper birch was especially a big target. And so there were helicopters spraying herbicides. There were, you know, people out there brushing these plants out, weeding them out with whatever way they could, whether they were hacking at them with saws or axes or chemicals. And I started noticing, because I actually had a job then with the Ministry of Forests to look at these plantations and measured that about 10% of these trees were dying to a fungal infection, a root disease. And so I knew there was something wrong, that these birch trees, taking out the birch trees, was creating an imbalance in the soil. And so I went back and did my PhD trying to figure this thing out, like, what the heck are we doing? Is this the right thing to do? And that policy had become so entrenched that they were spending millions and millions of dollars every year spraying our province. So it was not an easy thing to argue against.
What you were investigating sounds a little counterintuitive. I mean, you're suggesting that it's actually advantageous to the Douglas firs to have birch trees growing alongside them. I mean, you'd think they'd be competing for the same resources.
Right. You know, everybody was so focused on competition for light, especially. And I didn't see it that way. I saw in my upbringing in the forest, saw these plants as companions. And so I wanted to figure out how they might help each other. Why was the birch, when we were taking it out of the system, creating this disease in the forest? I was going to study the pathogenic fungi, but I ended up looking at instead at the fungi that all trees associate with, which are called mycorrhizal fungi. And these are helper fungi, where the fungus actually associates with the tree to grow through the soil, pick up nutrients and water, bring it back to the tree, and trade it for photosynthate. It was like an extension of their root systems.
So the fungi are sort of wrapping themselves around the tree roots, and it's sort of, they kind of almost become fused together.
Yeah, that's right. Right in the root tips, where the fungus grows around the cortical cells of the root of the tree, where the membranes of the plant and the membrane of the fungus meet, and that's where this exchange goes on.
Why was that so important?
Well, it was important to me because there was a new research coming out of the United Kingdom showing that in these garden boxes in the lab, that these fungi could actually connect trees together. At the time, the scientist, his name is Sir David Reed, was just looking at one species pine, and he grew these pines in these little garden boxes in the lab, and he labeled one with carbon-14, and he saw that the carbon-14 moved through the mycorrhizal network that linked these two trees together. And I wanted to know whether or not this was happening in our forest. Maybe this was the puzzle, that birch and fir were connected by their mycorrhizal fungi, and that this is what protected the fir. And so I started doing similar work to what David did, but I did it in the forest. And I would label my plants with carbon 14 and carbon 13 and watch these tracers move back and forth between the birch and fir. And I discovered that the more birch shaded Douglas fir, the more it gave carbon to Douglas fir. At the same time, it was competing for light. And so it was like the two trees were in this balance where they were actually competing and collaborating all at the same time.
So why would a forest work like this, where there are trees of different species that actually need each other to thrive?
A diverse forest tends to be more productive and healthier. So how does that work? Is that when you have a diversity of trees, say you've got like 10 tree species versus one, those trees occupy different niches in the forest. They all have different growth rates. They have different kinds of crowns. They capture light in different ways. Some of them hang out in the understory and are shade tolerant. Some like to be at the top and they're shade intolerant. And they capture different wavelengths of light, basically. And so it's easy to see then why a diverse forest is actually more productive, because it's able to capture the fuller suite of site resources. And that's not the whole story. The other thing is that if there are infections in the forest or herbivores, a lot of those pathogens and herbivores are very specific to certain species. And if you have that one species that, for example, lodgepole pine and mountain pine beetle, then you're going to lose the whole forest. Whereas if you have multiple species, say some aspen and spruce in there as well, then those other remaining species that are not attacked can take over and fill in the crown and maintain the productivity and the cycling in the forest, the water cycle, the nutrient cycles, the carbon cycles, provide habitat for all the creatures. So you still maintain a good, healthy forest.
My guest is Suzanne Simard, a forest ecologist at the University of British Columbia and the author of Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. This conversation is part of our series on kinship with the more than human world. So when you first came out with this study based on your doctoral work, and it was actually published in Nature, one of the premier science journals, and it was given this great title, The Wood Wide Web, which has sort of, you know, stuck ever since, you got a huge amount of pushback. It was not just from the timber industry. I mean, you were questioning their practices. It was a lot of other academics, ecologists who study these kind of things. What did people say to you?
Well, when I published the paper, I had a young family then. And yeah, there were a lot of criticisms coming out in the literature. Even at conferences, my work was getting criticized. And because I was so busy being a young mother at the time, I didn't respond to them very quickly, and the criticisms grew. It was kind of like, you know, one person started hammering at me and then became almost like a fashion. And before I knew it, my Nature work was getting cited in the literature. So were the criticisms. And so for me, this was really uncomfortable. I'd never experienced anything quite like this before. I felt like I created this hailstorm and I was suddenly this target.
Were you targeted partly, do you think, because you were a woman and this was a field dominated by men?
You know, I mean, I certainly was a woman and certainly the criticizers were men. And so you can put two and two together yourself. And it was in the 1990s. There weren't that many female scientists or female ecologists. And also, I think what I realized at the time, too, is that the work that David Reed did in the UK had created its own center, its own little hurricane, and there was controversy around the meaning of his work. And I think that I had kind of stepped into a hornet's nest, even regardless of me being a girl and them being men. They were already having their little debate in the UK. And I also realized that they'd been working in grasslands and moors and with small plants. And I was working in these forests that were cathedrals, where trees were 50 meters tall. It was a completely different environment.
So you have described yourself as, by nature, fairly shy. And you've said that you didn't really like public speaking, at least early in your career. You certainly didn't like confrontation. And here you were being very openly attacked. Your professional reputation was at stake. How did you deal with that?
You know, it was a real growing process for me. It was not easy at all. You're right. I'm shy. I've trained myself not to be so shy. But if I ever go to a party, like, I'm always the one that's like heading for the door first, because I can't talk to all these people about this stuff. And And then confrontation. I mean, I grew up, my mother would always run away from confrontation. And so that's what I learned. And so here I had this terrible combination of being shy and hating confrontation. And I had to overcome it. And I taught myself how to speak in public. It took me years to even learn how to speak up in a meeting. I mean, literally, it was painful. But, you know, now I can do it. You know, I encourage anybody who has those problems just to train yourself to overcome these things, because they can be a real setback in your career.
Yeah. So looking now, I mean, where you have taken this whole field of forest ecology, do you now think of a forest as almost like a single organism, as opposed to, you know, all these different competing trees?
I view it as a highly connected place where all the creatures are interdependent, and that we are one of those creatures. That interdependence makes you think of a single organism. It's not a single organism. It's a suite of organisms that are intimately linked together and affect each other in profound ways, and that they regulate the system. They shape that system.
Do you think a forest has intelligence? I mean, is that a word that you find useful?
I've used the word quite a bit. You know, let me qualify that. So, you know, trees don't have brains, they don't have nervous systems, and we've ascribed intelligence to ourselves, and we have brains and nervous systems. But what I've uncovered in the forest floor with my graduate students is that these trees form neural networks in the forest, not nervous networks, but neural networks. And what that means is that they have a pattern. And that pattern is that there are central hubs, like these big old trees, that are linked to their neighbors that are smaller plants or smaller trees. And that complexity, that pattern, is really efficient at moving information, at resilience. And even in these fungal networks, what I found was that even the chemicals moving through the networks, most of that is a chemical called glutamate. It's an amino acid, and it is the very same chemical that is actually a neurotransmitter in our own brains. And also, as I've learned that trees perceive and respond and are receptive to each other and are attuned to each other, I've come to realize that this is a form of intelligence. It's not a brain, but it's its own pattern that is a conserved pattern in nature that works.
You've come up with another idea, what you've called mother trees. What are these?
Well, so these are the hubs at the center of those networks. Hub trees are, or mother trees, are just the biggest, oldest trees in the forest. And the reason they're important is because they're highly connected to all the other trees and plants in the forest. So the reason that they're the most highly connected is that they have big root systems with lots of root tips, with mycorrhizal fungi that just go out and link with almost everything around them, the other trees that they're compatible with. So these are sort of the central linchpins of the forest. And then we did a bunch of experiments to find out, what do these old trees do? And it turns out that when seedlings actually link into these networks of these old trees, that it improves their survival and growth and nutrition, and that these trees also can transmit information and chemicals and help each other out.
I mean, this is not just other trees of the same species. You're talking about all kinds of different species. They are essentially talking with these other trees.
So yes, trees of different species link up because they have compatible generalist fungi that can link them together. They communicate with each other, and that ability to communicate or interact in that way helps them coexist. They work together to create a cohesive system when they can complement each other and coexist and help each other out and compete at the same time.
Yeah. Now, it's worth noting that the mother tree was a central idea in the blockbuster movie Avatar.
Yes.
Do you know if James Cameron got that from your work about mother trees?
Well, I have a strong sense that he did, but I don't know for sure. But I'll tell you what I do know is that right when Avatar was coming out, I got a phone call from a person who worked with James Cameron and had been participating in their workshops, and they had been reading my Nature paper. And so I think that it did influence the thinking. And since then, of course, James Cameron is working on more Avatar movies, and I'm involved. They've asked me to participate in a documentary film that's about the science behind Avatar. So,
oh, really? Wow.
They know about my work, and it's influenced the movies.
Now, there's something that you have been talking a bit about more recently. It's kind of a question you've raised, and that's whether trees have the capacity to perceive human beings. I'm wondering where you go with that.
This is an interesting question, and I haven't done any research on this myself. It's just an idea. But the reason I think this is that trees are responsive to, you know, all the creatures around them. So if, for example, a woodpecker pokes a hole in the bark, or if a budworm comes along and eats the needles off a tree, that interaction causes a cascade of biochemical responses in the trees. The different biochemical pathways, like the jasmonate pathway, is activated. Jasmonic acid is produced as a result, which is actually helps defend the plants against further attack. One of the pieces of work we did is we took some trees in the lab and we pulled the needles off. So we injured the trees, human beings, and we watched this cascade of responses in the plants. And then we also found out that the plants were able to communicate this injury to their neighbors through their mycorrhizal networks. And so I came to the realization that I injured this plant and it's responding and it's actually telling its neighbors about me, what I did. Maybe it didn't know I was a human. I don't know. But it got me thinking, and I kind of thought, well, why wouldn't they perceive us? They live for hundreds, if not thousands of years with people all around them doing things. And if you're in an orchard, like cutting their branches or pruning them, or don't you think that it makes sense?
Yeah.
And yeah, so.
Well, let me push on this a little bit. I mean, because it totally fascinates me. And I don't know if these are strictly science questions or whether it's something more than that. It sort of has more of an intuitive understanding of trees. I mean, I guess I'm wondering if this goes beyond just a tree sensing human presence, you know, when we cut them down or cut their branches, but whether it's more than that, or, you know, to take it even further, whether a tree might actually be able to distinguish between different people.
You know, my intuition says yes, and I'm not alone in this. And it's not just Western scientists, but the Aboriginal people of the world over have got certain principles that they live by. And one is that we are one with nature, that the creatures are relations, that we need to care for them as though they are our brothers and sisters. In fact, Aboriginal people, even in the West Coast of North America, probably all across North America, view trees as people. So there's the tree people. Robin Wall Kimmerer talks about the strawberry people. And we are perceiving these gifts of nature, and there are relations. Why wouldn't they perceive our gifts back or our exploitation back to them? And so, yes, it's partly philosophical, but it's also, if you start dissecting systems, you understand that all the parts of the system have relationships, that they're built to work together. And so to me, it's not a huge stretch of the imagination that they would perceive us and distinguish us. Who is an exploiter and who is a regenerative person?
Have you had relationships with specific trees?
Well, certainly I have. In my backyard, I have a beautiful maple tree that I go sit under every day. And yes, I have a relationship with that tree. And I have relationships with lots of trees, actually. Every day I go hiking in my favorite place in Nelson, where I live. And I talk to the pines and the firs and the aspens. And yeah, that's where my home is.
When you say you talk to them, I mean, you're talking out loud to them.
Yeah, I do. I pat them on the bark and I say, I hope you're having a great day. How are you today? I know it kind of sounds goofy, but that is just me. And
yeah. Well, I don't think it's goofy. I mean, I'm sort of fascinated by this because it raises this, you know, bigger question of how much of this is science in terms of, you know, what we can glean from the workings of nature, and how much of it is something else. Maybe it's a spiritual orientation. Maybe it's a philosophical way of looking at the world. And I know a lot of people sort of get frustrated, like always trying to put science in one box and this other way of thinking in the other box. And I'm wondering how you deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, the science that we're so used to right now is reductionist science. And, you know, it came from Western civilization where we reduced the parts of systems to study them as in isolation. And we've done that in forests, right? Trying to understand the trees and how they grow in isolation of all the other creatures. And it's like looking at the forest with just part of your eye open. There's so much to it that we'll never explain with our reductionist science, because when you put those parts back together, the soil, the tree, the plant, and hope that a forest grows, you're missing so much part of it. In fact, our plantations, you know, show that. And that part that's missing is the emergent property. You know, scientists call those the emergent properties of the ecosystem, things that you can't necessarily explain. Even the spirituality that we feel when we're in the forest is something that we can't actually put our finger on and study and say, oh, that feeling that I feel in the forest, it's because of this chemical and that chemical. No, it's something much bigger and more mysterious than that, but it's so important, right? It's our spirit. Like, we are spiritual beings and we need to get back to that. When I go out in the forest with my colleague, Dr. Teresa Ryan, who's Tsimshian Nation, and she's a cedar weaver and she peels bark from the cedar trees. When she goes to those trees, she lays her hands on the trees and talks to the tree and asks the tree permission to harvest some bark. And if the answer is no, then she doesn't do it. She goes to the next tree. Hmm. And so there's this relationship between her and the trees that is very heartening, and it's healthy, and it connects her. It connects all of us if we do that with our natural world, which are, you know, basically our relations.
So you've talked about how you talk to trees. I mean, when you go out for certain walks, do you have a sense that they talk back to you?
Yes, I do sense that. I mean, they don't have voices, but I get that feeling of belonging. As soon as I walk in the forest, I know I belong, and I thank the trees for what they have shown me. And I feel they're waiting for the discoveries so that we can all understand this. And I think that there's a gratitude. I feel it when I walk in the forest.
Now, I know some ecologists now talk about kinship as a way of understanding a lot of these connections that you're describing within the natural world. And I mean, there's biological kinship, and then there's sort of kinship at a whole different level. And also our relationship with the non-human world. Does that word or that concept of kinship resonate for you?
It definitely does. This kincentric way of seeing the world, that we're all related. Where I live in British Columbia, we only have 8% of our old growth forest left because the province has been clear cut. And the consequence is, you know, we can't meet our carbon emissions. Our creeks are flooding over. We have wildfires that are running through, like, young plantations that are very flammable. If we want to change that trajectory, we have to reimagine how we relate with forests, to rediscover our kinship with all these creatures, that we are in a concentric circle, that we're all linked together. What humans do to forests is going to come back, and is coming back, to affect us. And we need to reconnect and fulfill our obligations to the land and to nature and be responsible for what we do instead of just being exploiters. Mm-hmm.
So clearly there are better and worse ways to grow and harvest trees. Is it possible to have a viable timber industry that really supplies the needs of the human needs of the world that is sustainable?
Yeah, I think there is. Right now, the demand for wood is so high, and we in the marketplace is, oh, we need to supply that demand at any cost. If we can make money from it, we can do it. It's like, should we exploit every drop of oil from the earth just because we can? No, we need to regulate this. Like, we don't have to use so much of the resources of the world. In fact, it's going to kill us if we just keep exploiting like that.
So how would forestry, how would logging change in a sustainable way?
Right now, we're overcutting, right? We can't sustain this rate of cut. And so we need to pull back and reduce the cut. And then when we do cut, we need to not cut the remaining old growth forests, of which is only, like I said, 8% left, because of their biodiversity and carbon, incredible carbon storage capacity, and refocus our efforts on second growth forests, or forests that have already, you know, lost so much. And we can rejuvenate those forests by favoring the mother trees when we go to cut, leave them behind and protect them by having groups of them and allowing them to regenerate on their own and helping them along if we need to by planting. And then we also need to migrate species, because the velocity of climate change is so rapid that these trees will and seedlings will not be able to keep up. These mother trees can help bootstrap these new migrants into the forest. At the same time, we can take out some trees and still provide wood for people. That's okay. Like, we need to do that. But we
and you're
need
saying
to do
it. And you think we can generate enough wood doing it that way?
I think we can. I think we need to reevaluate how much wood we need. Do we really need to cut down whole forests, ship logs overseas to build things that maybe are not absolutely necessary, you know, that is just sort of feeding a voracious machine that will take as much as we'll give? Do we need to use so much paper? Do we need to produce so much toilet paper? So in British Columbia, for example, we've decided that we're going to turn some of our old growth forests into wood pellets, and we're going to send those wood pellets overseas to feed the European market for wood stoves as a substitute for fossil fuel energy.
Oh, God. Oh.
Yeah, I know. And the damage to the ecosystem is immense, but we haven't thought it all through, right? Just because there's a market demand that's suddenly been created, does that mean we cut down our boreal forest to create wood pellets? It's a disaster because that carbon gets emitted back into the atmosphere. So we really need to be much more judicious about our decision making. You know, as a global community, like, we're talking about survival here. We can't be making these kinds of decisions and hope for the best. They have to be done with intelligence.
There's one line you have actually right near the beginning of your book where you say, you wrote this not so we can save the trees. Really, the question is how the trees might save us. Do you want to explain that?
Right. Forests cover about a third of the land area, but they supply like 3/4 of our water. They house 80% of our species. They store most of our carbon, 80% or more, in the soil. They suck up about a third of the man-made carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions. And so they really are our life support systems. If we don't have forests, we wouldn't be here. Or it would be a planet of a lot of human suffering and suffering all around. So yes, the forests, they are our life support system. And it is... it's in our own self-interest as well as everybody else's to protect these places. We're going to help forests, but they're essential for us. Without them, we would be gone.
Yeah. Suzanne, this has been so fun to talk with you. Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you so much.
That's Suzanne Simard, a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia and the author of Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. This interview is part of our podcast series on kinship with the more than human world, which is produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge in partnership with the Center for Humans and Nature and with support from the Calliopeia Foundation. Our sound designer is Sarah Hopeful, and I'm Steve Paulson. If you want to find more in our kinship series, go to ttbook.org/kinship, where you'll see all our podcast episodes and also a lot of great essays. Thanks for joining us.